Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ashley Thompson and Mario Ritter Jr. But first, this report with help from John Russell.
Comedian George Carlin is famous for talking about language. He is famous for criticizing indirect or overly pleasant speech. Consider these lines from one of his performances.
I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality.
Today, we will explore the case of euphemisms, pleasant or nice words that take the place of direct language. We will give you examples of euphemisms and explain why they are so common.
In earlier everyday grammar stories, we discussed how Americans sometimes choose indirect speech. They consider it to be more polite. What takes the place of direct speech? Americans often replace it with creative noun phrases, phrasal verbs, or expressions. These words give the same basic meaning as direct language, but they have a very different style. Americans often use euphemisms when talking about sensitive topics. Death, love, body processes, anything they might not want to speak of directly. Here is an example. Consider the noun alcohol. Alcohol consumption can be a taboo topic in American society. So, some restaurants and stores sell adult beverages instead. The term adult beverages is a euphemism. It refers to alcohol, but in an indirect manner.
You might think that euphemisms are very informal or slang. You might think that euphemisms are silly. But Americans often use euphemisms when talking about serious issues. Death, for one. Consider the verb die. In euphemistic language, Americans often replace it with the phrasal verb pass away. When expressing news about a person's death, Americans might say, I was sad to hear that so-and-so passed away. Americans often send condolence cards to those who have lost friends or family. These condolence cards often do not use the verb die. Instead, they use euphemistic or indirect language. Here is another example. Instead of saying euthanize or even kill, Americans might say put to sleep. Put to sleep sounds much gentler and kinder than euthanize or kill. Parents often use this structure when a child's beloved pet needs to be euthanized by a veterinarian. The reason they do this is to avoid making the child sadder about the situation.
Euphemisms are not always used to talk about sensitive topics. Sometimes business people create euphemisms to increase sales. Consider this example. If you were to ask Americans if they would like to eat Patagonian toothfish, they would probably say no. Toothfish just does not sound like an appealing food to eat. However, if you were to ask Americans if they would like to eat Chilean sea bass, they might say yes. The two names refer to the exact same kind of fish. Ralph Keyes is an author. He wrote Euphemania, a book about euphemisms. In an interview with NPR, Keyes noted that, at one time, Patagonian toothfish was freely available to anyone because no one wanted to eat it, until a very clever entrepreneurial sea importer renamed it Chilean sea bass. Now, you will see Chilean sea bass on menus at expensive restaurants. The lowly toothfish has come a long way.
Euphemisms often make sentences longer. They can also take away clarity, especially in writing. For these reasons, writing style guides often recommend that writers not use euphemisms or indirect language. Whether you like euphemisms or not, you should learn some of the common ones. They play a part in American culture, for better or for worse. The next time you are watching a film, listening to music, or reading the news, try to look for euphemistic language. Ask yourself why the speaker or writer might want to use a euphemism instead of direct language. We will leave you with a euphemism from the 2004 comedy Anchorman. Actor Will Ferrell is expressing surprise. Instead of using bad or offensive words, he refers to Odin, a character in Norse mythology. Americans do not use this expression. They rarely refer to Norse mythology. That is part of the humor of the line.
Oh, great Odin's raven!
I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm John Russell.
The way a person's eyes move can show whether or not the person recognizes someone else, even if they try to hide it. That is what a team of international researchers reported recently. The finding could be important for criminal investigators who often seek information from uncooperative witnesses or suspects. Law enforcement officers often turn to lie detector tests during criminal investigations, but the test results are not always correct. When asked questions critical to a criminal case, a fast heartbeat or sweaty, sticky hands might make a nervous truth-teller appear to be lying. And an experienced liar might be able to control those signs and avoid suspicion. Our eyes look at a familiar face differently than they do an unfamiliar one. When people look at unfamiliar faces, their eyes usually move from one feature, like the shape of the nose, to other features. Their eyes stop quickly and often as they try to identify the unknown person. When looking at a familiar face, people usually direct their attention to just a few facial features. The researchers wanted to know if people could control their eye movements when attempting to hide the fact that they recognize a face. Elisa Millen is a psychology researcher at the University of Stirling in Britain. She led the team that carried out the study. Millen said, humans are experts at familiar face recognition. Recognition of a familiar face is fast and reflexive. The researchers showed 48 students pictures of both strangers and professors they knew. They asked all of the students to try to appear honest while lying about recognizing familiar faces. Half of the test subjects were told about a method that might help them hide their recognition. The researchers told those students to stop in the same areas when looking at both familiar and unfamiliar faces. Their eyes would start on the person's forehead. Next, they looked at each eye, then moved from one ear to the other, then down to the nose, mouth, and chin. In most cases, the students who were given suggestions for how to hide their recognition were not able to do so. When looking at a familiar face, their eyes still stopped for longer periods of time and had fewer stops in the inner parts of the face, the researchers noted. Millen said that hiding markers for facial recognition in eye movements is difficult, especially if you know that person well. She added, the more the students tried to hide recognition of a face, the more apparent it was. Millen hopes that her findings can someday be used by law enforcement. She believes such knowledge could help investigators have a clearer understanding of who is connected to whom in a criminal case. Deborah Hanula is a psychology professor at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. She was not involved in the study. She said of the research, "It's incredibly important to detect whether someone knows something and isn't willing to reveal that in cases that have high importance, like terrorist investigations." Hanula and Millen both agree that while the method is promising, it needs a stronger experimental base before it can be used by law enforcement. Millen noted that she and her team explored only one method of trying to hide recognition. Many other methods could exist, she said. Some might even be more effective. It is also not yet clear what effect the degree of familiarity has. In order for the method to be used in criminal cases, it needs to be effective for faces that are very familiar, as well as only partly familiar. The research appears in the scientific publication Cognitive Research, Principles and Implications. I'm Ashley Thompson.
Scientists are working to stop a deadly virus that infects pigs. The virus is causing huge losses for farmers in China and other Asian countries. Many farmers have tried to contain African swine flu by quarantining pigs and destroying infected animals. But the spread of the disease into East Asia has intensified the search for other ways to deal with the problem. The virus had not been considered a major concern for researchers until it appeared in China last year. Chinese farmers raise about half of the world's pigs. Some researchers think the virus might have come from infected animals in Eastern Europe or Russia. Since then, it has spread to China, Vietnam, and other Asian countries. Millions of pigs have been destroyed. Although swine flu does not sicken people, it is very contagious and deadly to pigs. Today's situation, where you have this global threat, puts a lot more emphasis on this research, said Dr. Luis Rodriguez. He spoke to the Associated Press. Rodriguez leads the United States Government Laboratory for Foreign Animal Diseases at Plum Island, New York. Vaccines often are developed by killing a virus before it is injected into an animal. The disabled virus does not make the animal sick, but it activates the body's natural defenses against the disease. The immune system is then able to identify the virus and produce antibodies against it. However, this method is not effective with all viruses, including the one that causes African swine flu. For swine flu, scientists have been working on a different kind of vaccine. It is made from a weakened virus, not a dead one. The problem for researchers has been how to change the virus so it can be safely used. Vietnam's government reported a few weeks ago that it was testing vaccines, but provided few details of its programs. In China, the government said scientists are working on a vaccine that genetically changes the virus. That is similar to a method being used by scientists in the United States. The U.S. Department of Agriculture said it recently signed an agreement with a vaccine manufacturer to study and develop one of three possible vaccines from the Plum Island Center. All the experimental vaccines use genetically changed viruses, which have some of the genes removed. But the vaccine finally chosen by researchers needs to be tested in large numbers of pigs before it is ready for approval. Linda Dixon is a biologist at Britain's Pirbright Institute, which studies diseases in farm animals. She said the testing can take from 2 to 5 years. Even if vaccines become available, it is not clear if they will work everywhere. For example, vaccines developed for the virus in China and Europe may not work in African countries south of the Sahara Desert, where the disease has existed much longer. Daniel Rock once led Plum Island's African swine flu program. He suggested that some areas might have more success against the disease by killing sick animals. But Rock noted that the disease's huge outbreaks around the world have made developing a vaccine an important goal for U.S. researchers. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Today, we visit one of the most unusual national parks in the United States. It is called the Dry Tortugas National Park. It includes 7 small islands. They are about 200 kilometers off the coast of the state of Florida. One of the islands was once a prison. The first European to see the small islands was the Spanish explorer Ponce de León. He arrived by ship in 1513. Ponce de León was an older man who was searching for special water that stories said would make him young again. It was called the Fountain of Youth. Ponce de León named the islands the Tortugas. Tortuga is the Spanish word for turtle. Thousands of turtles lived on the islands. Ponce de León was able to capture many of these creatures to provide meat for his ship's crew. He never did find the Fountain of Youth. In fact, the islands had no fresh water on them at all. The tortugas were dry. The word dry began to appear on early maps of the area to warn ships that they could not find fresh water there. Centuries later, America's third president, Thomas Jefferson, took an interest in the islands. He hoped they could become a place that could help protect ships traveling in a large area of water called the Florida Straits. He proposed a military base be built there. In 1821, the United States took control of Florida and its islands. Construction of a military fort began in 1848, long after Jefferson's death. The fort was to be the home of 1,500 men and 450 huge cannons. The fort's name? Fort Jefferson. Fort Jefferson was never really completed. It had to be worked on continually. The salt air, wind, water, and sand quickly caused problems. The weight of the fort's heavy brick walls made them sink into the sand. Slaves and prisoners did the building and repair work at the fort. Many of the prisoners were army troops. They had been found guilty of crimes and ordered to serve their sentences at Fort Jefferson. In July of 1865, 4 new prisoners arrived at Fort Jefferson. They had been found guilty of taking part in the successful plot to murder the President of the U.S., Abraham Lincoln. One of the prisoners was sentenced for giving medical aid to the man who killed President Lincoln. He was also found guilty of being an active member of the assassination plot. That man was Samuel Alexander Mudd. He was a 32-year-old doctor from the state of Maryland. He was sentenced to spend the rest of his life doing hard labor at Fort Jefferson. The walls at Fort Jefferson were about 15 meters tall. Inside the walls of the fort were hundreds of rooms. Most of them held guns that pointed out to the sea. Many other buildings were also inside the huge fort. No prisoner had ever successfully escaped from Fort Jefferson. It was more than 200 kilometers across open ocean to the nearest occupied land. Samuel Alexander Mudd must have believed the fort would be his home for the rest of his life, but he was wrong. In 1867, Dr. Mudd was helping the prison doctor treat victims of yellow fever. Many people died from yellow fever. Soon, the prison doctor lost his own battle with the disease. Only Dr. Mudd was left to treat the increasing number of men who became sick with yellow fever. Later, the sickness seemed to leave the island. Many of those who survived knew they owed their lives to Dr. Mudd. Almost every man in Fort Jefferson wrote to the President of the United States, asking that Mudd be pardoned because of his work treating patients with yellow fever. They called Mudd a hero. In February of 1869, President Andrew Johnson signed a presidential pardon. Mudd was a free man. He left Fort Jefferson and returned to his home in Maryland. He once again became a family doctor. In 1874, the American Army left Fort Jefferson. Modern artillery made the fort no longer useful. Today, the old fort and empty little islands provide a protected home for thousands of birds, fish, and sea turtles. Visitors travel for hours on high-speed boats that bring them to the islands from Key West, Florida. They swim in the warm waters and enjoy the bright Florida sun. Many try snorkeling or scuba diving to explore the underwater shipwrecks. Still others bring tents and spend a few days living on the white sand beaches. Thousands of visitors make the trip to the Dry Tortugas National Park every year. Of course, soldiers no longer greet them when they arrive at Fort Jefferson. Now, friendly members of the National Park Service do. They meet every boat filled with visitors. They smile and say, "Welcome to Fort Jefferson and the Dry Tortugas National Park." The small island's days as a prison are long past. Yet, almost every visitor to the park asks about its most famous prisoner, Dr. Samuel Alexander Mudd. They ask to see his room. Most people know that the doctor did not end up spending the rest of his life in the Fort Jefferson prison. Only a few of the huge cannons remain at the park. They help show visitors what the old fort looked like. The weather continues to affect the fort's grounds and buildings, so workers continue to fight against environmental damage. The park extends over an area of more than 26,000 hectares. Almost all of this is ocean and living coral reefs that protect the islands. Many ships have sunk in the waters around the islands over the centuries. The wrecks of these ships help provide safe places for many fish. Thousands of kinds of fish live in these waters. Some visitors are even lucky enough to see sea turtles swimming in the clear blue waters. Dry Tortugas is also home to many seabirds. Visitors are not permitted on some of the islands within the park to protect birds that are laying eggs. The striking natural beauty and relaxed feel of the islands today seems far different from Dry Tortugas' earlier history as a lonely, inescapable prison. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.